This is the University of Cambridge Local Examination Syndicate, International General Certificate of Secondary Education, November 2002 examination in English as a second language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your name, center number, and candidate number on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you are doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready, here is the test. Look at the questions for part one. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Which platform will Lara need to go to in order to meet her friend from Newcastle?
Excuse me, has the 5:23 from Newcastle arrived yet? It was due to come in on this platform. 11B, that's right, isn't it?
No, I'm sorry. It's delayed and has been diverted to platform 9C. It should be there in 5 minutes.
Excuse me, has the 5:23 from Newcastle arrived yet? It was due to come in on this platform. 11B, that's right, isn't it?
No, I'm sorry. It's delayed and has been diverted to platform 9C. It should be there in 5 minutes.
Question 2. How will Tandy and her friend find their way around the closed road?
The road ahead is shut.
Yes, Tandy, I forgot. It's the regional marathon running race today, and it begins here. We'll have to find another route.
Oh, there's a yellow diversion sign over there. Follow the black arrow. The road ahead is shut.
Yes, Tandy, I forgot. It's the regional marathon running race today, and it begins here. We'll have to find another route.
Oh, there's a yellow diversion sign over there. Follow the black arrow.
Question 3. Atta telephones the library. What does he want to do about his books? And what is the new date given to him by the librarian?
Hello, I haven't finished reading my library books. Could I have them for a bit longer, please?
Yes. What is your ticket number, please?
B634-298-00Z.
They are renewed until December the 19th now.
Hello, I haven't finished reading my library books. Could I have them for a bit longer, please?
Yes. What is your ticket number, please?
B634-298-00Z.
They are renewed until December the 19th now.
Question 4. The Smith family is on a car journey. What does Dad agree to listen to, and where is it to be found?
Are we nearly there yet, Dad? Can we listen to some music on the radio, please? Something modern and lively.
I'd rather listen to a tape of a book. How about that...
No, some music.
Okay, but classical then. I'll find station 103 on the radio.
Are we nearly there yet, Dad? Can we listen to some music on the radio, please? Something modern and lively.
I'd rather listen to a tape of a book. How about that...
No, some music.
Okay, but classical then. I'll find station 103 on the radio.
Question 5. Where can Alexa buy a newspaper?
Excuse me, do you sell newspapers?
No, I'm sorry, we don't. And neither does the supermarket across the road. The newsagents have closed. It's too late for them. I know the petrol station at the crossroads sells them and is open until 10 o'clock. Try there.
Excuse me, do you sell newspapers?
No, I'm sorry, we don't. And neither does the supermarket across the road. The newsagents have closed. It's too late for them. I know the petrol station at the crossroads sells them and is open until 10 o'clock. Try there.
Question 6. Your friend has left a message on your answer phone. What are her 3 reasons for putting off your arrangements?
I'm sorry, but I have too much homework to go out tonight, and the film we were going to see is sold out. Also, I have no money until I finish my paper delivery round at the weekend. Can we postpone going out until then? I'm sorry, but I have too much homework to go out tonight, and the film we were going to see is sold out. Also, I have no money until I finish my paper delivery round at the weekend. Can we postpone going out until then?
That is the last question in part 1. In a moment, you will hear part 2. Now look at the questions for part 2, exercise 1. Part 2. Part 2, Exercise 1. Question 7. Listen to the following interview about tigers in India, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening, and welcome to On the Trail of the Tiger, our special nature program about this endangered species. Sumitra Raj, you're going to tell us about tigers in India and about how we can see them in their natural habitat.
Yes, India has always had a strong association with animals, and tigers feature strongly in its history and culture. Recently, the association Project Tiger was formed to try and protect this beautiful animal from extinction.
Is that true? Are they really a threatened species?
Yes. They're dying out as a result of hunting and irresponsible destruction of their habitat by humans. Originally, tigers were to be found in much of Central and Southern Asia, but now their numbers and locations are much fewer.
Could you tell us about tigers themselves?
Well, as you probably know, they're the largest of the cat family. They can grow to 3.6 meters long. That's pretty big, with a tail length of nearly a meter. Fully grown tigers can weigh as much as 300 kilograms. The tiger's coat is a yellowy-orange with black stripes, and Indian tigers tend to be darker in colour than the paler Siberian tiger.
Do they live in groups?
No, tigers are solitary animals. They live on their own and mark the edge of their territory with scent and scrape marks. Then they roar to keep other tigers away. You can hear the roars up to 3 kilometres away, you know.
And their prey?
They come out at night to hunt for wild boar, deer and other forest animals.
So, can we go and see tigers without disturbing them?
Oh, yes. Most parks and sanctuaries throughout India are now well set up for visitors and can provide everything from accommodation and trained guides to restaurants.
When's the best time of year to do this?
The best time to visit is between October and April. You could go to Ranthambore National Park, for example. This park was originally a fort and now has a special area designated for Project Tiger, where a safe natural habitat is provided. The center of the park is ringed by 2 mountain ranges, which form the perfect surroundings for the tigers, which live and hunt in the low hills and valleys. Often, you would have to wait a while to actually see a tiger, though.
With a guide?
Oh, yes, of course. The guides know where to look for the tigers. If you spot a group of deer at the water's edge, for example, a guide would know that this would be a prime prey target for a hungry tiger.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening, and welcome to On the Trail of the Tiger, our special nature program about this endangered species. Sumitra Raj, you're going to tell us about tigers in India, and about how we can see them in their natural habitat.
Yes, India has always had a strong association with animals, and tigers feature strongly in its history and culture. Recently, the association Project Tiger was formed to try and protect this beautiful animal from extinction.
Is that true? Are they really a threatened species?
Yes. They're dying out as a result of hunting and irresponsible destruction of their habitat by humans. Originally, tigers were to be found in much of Central and Southern Asia, but now their numbers and locations are much fewer.
Could you tell us about tigers themselves?
Well, as you probably know, they're the largest of the cat family. They can grow to 3.6 meters long. That's pretty big, with a tail length of nearly a meter. Fully grown tigers can weigh as much as 300 kilograms. The tiger's coat is a yellowy-orange with black stripes, and Indian tigers tend to be darker in colour than the paler Siberian tiger.
Do they live in groups?
No, tigers are solitary animals. They live on their own and mark the edge of their territory with scent and scrape marks. Then they roar to keep other tigers away. You can hear the roars up to 3 kilometres away, you know.
And their prey?
They come out at night to hunt for wild boar, deer and other forest animals.
So, can we go and see tigers without disturbing them?
Oh, yes. Most parks and sanctuaries throughout India are now well set up for visitors and can provide everything from accommodation and trained guides to restaurants.
When's the best time of year to do this?
The best time to visit is between October and April. You could go to Ranthambore National Park, for example. This park was originally a fort and now has a special area designated for Project Tiger, where a safe natural habitat is provided. The center of the park is ringed by 2 mountain ranges, which form the perfect surroundings for the tigers, which live and hunt in the low hills and valleys. Often, you would have to wait a while to actually see a tiger, though.
With a guide?
Oh, yes, of course. The guides know where to look for the tigers. If you spot a group of deer at the water's edge, for example, a guide would know that this would be a prime prey target for a hungry tiger.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2. Question 8. Listen to the following interview about the recent navigation of the Northwest Passage, a route across the top of North America, and then fill in the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
After 400 years of trying, an ice-free route has been found across the top of North America. Captain Burton piloted the ship called the St. Roch II on its voyage through this shortcut. Captain, surely ice has always been the problem on this route.
Yes, but where was the ice during our journey? We travelled almost 1,600 kilometres from the Beaufort Sea, which is to the northwest of Alaska, through the Western Arctic to Greenland. That is, we sailed from west to east around the very top of the world. We sailed through open water. We didn't get stuck in any ice.
So what are the implications of your journey?
Since 1576, explorers have been trying to find a shortcut to China across the top of Alaska. Well, for trade, this would be a wonderful route. A normal route from the Netherlands to Japan, for example, would be 10,000 kilometers. Our route would cut thousands of kilometers off the journey. Really, our Arctic Circle shortcut has raised hopes of exploiting the commercial potential of this far north coast. You know, it took us less than a month to complete our voyage through these normally frozen waters.
Where was the ice, then?
Going back to your question about the implications of the voyage, we're actually very worried that we saw no ice.
Why? Oh, global warming, perhaps.
Yes. Some ecologists say the fact that the Arctic Passage was ice-free as we sailed through it is a result of the world warming up and the ice caps melting. It could be climate change, though, or perhaps we were just lucky. Until other boats try this route, we won't know. Certainly scientists have recorded the reduction in the ice caps as 6% since 1980. That's a lot.
Is your route to be used by shipping at once?
Oh, no. There are still two places along the route, one off Alaska and another further on, where the opening and closing of the ice gates depends on the wind, not just global warming. We were definitely lucky at both these places.
Before you go, tell us about your boat. Is it huge and well-equipped?
No, it's a small police boat, just a patrol boat, really. But our journey was inspired by and based upon an expedition made in 1944 by the St. Roch I. And that boat was made of wood. That journey, with the mission of supplying very remote outposts, lasted 27 months.
Captain Burton, many congratulations on your successful pioneering journey.
Now you will hear the interview again.
After 400 years of trying, an ice-free route has been found across the top of North America. Captain Burton piloted the ship called the St. Roch II on its voyage through this shortcut. Captain, surely ice has always been the problem on this route.
Yes, but where was the ice during our journey? We travelled almost 1,600 kilometres from the Beaufort Sea, which is to the northwest of Alaska, through the Western Arctic to Greenland. That is, we sailed from west to east around the very top of the world. We sailed through open water. We didn't get stuck in any ice.
So what are the implications of your journey?
Since 1576, explorers have been trying to find a shortcut to China across the top of Alaska. Well, for trade, this would be a wonderful route. A normal route from the Netherlands to Japan, for example, would be 10,000 kilometers. Our route would cut thousands of kilometers off the journey. Really, our Arctic Circle shortcut has raised hopes of exploiting the commercial potential of this far north coast. You know, it took us less than a month to complete our voyage through these normally frozen waters.
Where was the ice, then?
Going back to your question about the implications of the voyage, we're actually very worried that we saw no ice.
Why? Oh, global warming, perhaps.
Yes. Some ecologists say the fact that the Arctic Passage was ice-free as we sailed through it is a result of the world warming up and the ice caps melting. It could be climate change, though, or perhaps we were just lucky. Until other boats try this route, we won't know. Certainly, scientists have recorded the reduction in the ice caps as 6% since 1980. That's a lot.
Is your route to be used by shipping at once?
Oh, no. There are still two places along the route, one off Alaska and another further on, where the opening and closing of the ice gates depends on the wind, not just global warming. We were definitely lucky at both these places.
Before you go, tell us about your boat. Is it huge and well-equipped?
No, it's a small police boat, just a patrol boat, really. But our journey was inspired by and based upon an expedition made in 1944 by the St. Roch One, and that boat was made of wood. That journey, with the mission of supplying very remote outposts, lasted 27 months.
Captain Burton, many congratulations on your successful pioneering journey. That is the end of part two. In a moment, you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 1. Question 9. Listen to the following interview about a famous cycle race in France, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening, and welcome to Sports Report. Tonight we welcome Alan Muller, an experienced Tour de France cyclist who's going to tell us about this famous race. Alain, is the Tour de France a new cycle race?
No. It was started 99 years ago in 1903. The idea was that the race would cover much of the French countryside, nearly 4,000 kilometres in fact, beginning in the west and working anti-clockwise around the country, ending in Paris. It was planned to last a total of 5 weeks in the summer months. Only 15 people entered for this first race, so eventually the time schedule was cut to 19 days, and a large list of competitors was very soon compiled.
Nearly 4,000 kilometres. You must have to be very fit.
Oh, yes. The Tour de France has been likened to running 19 marathons in 3 weeks. We ride up to 160 kilometres each day, and that's quite a lot. And it includes some of the toughest regions in France for a cyclist. The Alps and the Pyrenees, for example, which means riding through mountain terrain.
So, how is the race organized?
Well, it's broken down into stages. The winner is the cyclist who finishes the race in the shortest overall time. Now, that's not necessarily the rider who wins the most stages.
Ah, so the times are all added together as the riders finish each stage of the race?
Well, yes. and the overall race leader gets to wear the famous yellow jersey. The leader of the mountain stages has the honour of wearing a red and white dotted jersey, and there's also a green jersey, which the fastest sprinter wears.
And everyone rides together?
The participants race as teams, each with a team leader. And the function of the team is to help the team leader to keep up to speed, to shelter him from wind and to supply him with a bottle of water if he's thirsty. Usually, these cyclists are sponsored by way of financing their preparation and race costs.
So you're sponsored to cover costs only?
Yes, but remember, there's the equivalent of £1.1 million prize money involved in the Tour de France. And the overall winner gets a massive £196,600. Several of the individual stages also have cash prizes.
So how many people take part?
About 200, but only half of those would be expected to complete the whole race.
Uh-huh. Do you get a lot of support from spectators?
Oh, yes. About 1 million people a day come and watch us cycle past. And we also have a worldwide TV audience.
What a wonderful atmosphere the race must have. Alain, thank you for telling us about the Tour de France, and best wishes for your next competition.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening, and welcome to Sports Report. Tonight we welcome Alain Muller, an experienced Tour de France cyclist who's going to tell us about this famous race. Alain, is the Tour de France a new cycle race?
No, it was started 99 years ago in 1903. The idea was that the race would cover much of the French countryside, nearly 4,000 kilometres in fact, beginning in the west and working anti-clockwise around the country, ending in Paris. It was planned to last a total of 5 weeks in the summer months. Only 15 people entered for this first race, so eventually the time schedule was cut to 19 days, and a large list of competitors was very soon compiled.
Nearly 4,000 kilometres. You must have to be very fit.
Oh, yes. The Tour de France has been likened to running 19 marathons in 3 weeks. We ride up to 160 kilometres each day, and that's quite a lot. And it includes some of the toughest regions in France for a cyclist. The Alps and the Pyrenees, for example, which means riding through mountain terrain.
So how is the race organised?
Well, it's broken down into stages. The winner is the cyclist who finishes the race in the shortest overall time. That's not necessarily the rider who wins the most stages.
Oh, so the times are all added together as the riders finish each stage of the race?
Well, yes. The overall race leader gets to wear the famous yellow jersey. The leader of the mountain stages has the honour of wearing a red and white dotted jersey. And there's also a green jersey, which the fastest sprinter wears.
And everyone rides together?
The participants race as teams, each with a team leader. And the function of the team is to help the team leader to keep up to speed, to shelter him from wind and to supply him with a bottle of water if he's thirsty. Usually, these cyclists are sponsored by way of financing their preparation and race costs.
So you're sponsored to cover costs only?
Yes, but remember, there's the equivalent of £1.1 million prize money involved in the Tour de France. The overall winner gets a massive £196,600. Several of the individual stages also have cash prizes.
So how many people take part?
About 200, but only half of those would be expected to complete the whole race.
Uh-huh. Do you get a lot of support from spectators?
Oh, yes. About 1 million people a day come and watch us cycle past. And we also have a worldwide TV audience.
What a wonderful atmosphere the race must have. Alain, thank you for telling us about the Tour de France, and best wishes for your next competition.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment, you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3. Exercise 2. Question 10. Listen to the following interview with the chief executive of a company which makes maps, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Have you ever wondered how all the information is put into maps? Shamzad Lamini is the first female boss in the history of one of the largest mapping companies in the world. Welcome, Shamza. Tell us about how maps are made.
Well, I head an international company which has been in existence for 211 years. A lot of maps have been made in that time. We currently have nearly 2,000 people working for us, and we have branches all over the world.
The process of making maps must have changed throughout the years, especially as we're now in the age of computers.
Yes, we have electronic maps, maps generated by computer, and maps which originate from new satellite pictures. Do you know that the cameras in some of the satellites which orbit our planet can take photos of the Earth's surface down to accurate detail, and they can be updated daily? You see, our environment is in a constant state of change, so it's important to be able to adjust for this with the latest information available to us.
How far away from Earth are those cameras in the satellites?
Oh, nearly 700 kilometers. Incredible, isn't it? Do you know that you can even buy a navigation system for your car nowadays, which will locate you to within 10 meters of your true position? There's no problem about finding your way around when you can use one of those systems.
And there must be lots of other advantageous uses for such a system.
Yes, you're quite right. Some systems update their information second by second and could lead you to, for example, a free parking place, or to the cinema showing the film you wish to see, or could even find a child that has wandered off.
That's wonderful. I still think of a map as being a folded piece of paper.
So do most people. And indeed, we still sell £25 million worth of paper maps every year, mainly things like tourist maps. They're especially popular, of course. People feel quite secure about travel in a new area or country if they have a current map with them. Maps today do more than this, though. They're relevant to every practical area of our lives. Think how many businesses rely upon geographical information and consider how many of our own decisions are made upon this basis, deciding where to live or shop, for example, or how to travel, perhaps, or deciding where to work or study.
Okay, you have a massive responsibility then as head of the mapping agency. Why did you want a career in map making?
I've always loved geography. I'm fascinated by countries and people, and I like to travel. I have a vision, too, of the importance of geographical information in relation to the way in which the world of the future will work.
Thank you very much, Shamzad Lamini.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Have you ever wondered how all the information is put into maps? Shamzad Lamini is the first female boss in the history of one of the largest mapping companies in the world. Welcome, Shamza. Tell us about how maps are made.
Well, I head an international company which has been in existence for 211 years. A lot of maps have been made in that time. We currently have nearly 2,000 people working for us, and we have branches all over the world.
The process of making maps must have changed throughout the years, especially as we're now in the age of computers.
Yes, we have electronic maps, maps generated by computer, and maps which originate from new satellite pictures. Do you know that the cameras in some of the satellites which orbit our planet can take photos of the Earth's surface down to accurate detail, and they can be updated daily? You see, our environment is in a constant state of change, so it's important to be able to adjust for this with the latest information available to us.
How far away from Earth are those cameras in the satellites?
Oh, nearly 700 kilometers. Incredible, isn't it? Do you know that you can even buy a navigation system for your car nowadays, which will locate you to within 10 meters of your true position? There's no problem about finding your way around when you can use one of those systems.
And there must be lots of other advantageous uses for such a system.
Yes, you're quite right. Some systems update their information second by second and could lead you to, for example, a free parking place, or to the cinema showing the film you wish to see, or could even find a child that has wandered off.
That's wonderful. I still think of a map as being a folded piece of paper.
So do most people. And indeed, we still sell £25 million worth of paper maps every year, mainly things like tourist maps. They're especially popular, of course. People feel quite secure about travel in a new area or country if they have a current map with them. Maps today do more than this, though. They're relevant to every practical area of our lives. Think how many businesses rely upon geographical information and consider how many of our own decisions are made upon this basis, deciding where to live or shop, for example, or how to travel, perhaps. Or deciding where to work or study.
Okay, you have a massive responsibility then as head of the mapping agency. Why did you want a career in map making?
I've always loved geography. I'm fascinated by countries and people, and I like to travel. I have a vision, too, of the importance of geographical information in relation to the way in which the world of the future will work.
Thank you very much, Shamsat Lamini.
That is the end of part three and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, center number, and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all the papers collected. Thank you, everyone.